Maya Lin's career began famously when her design for the Vietnam Memorial in Washington was selected while she was still an undergraduate at Yale. Since then, her work as an artist and architect has transcended category and expanded the boundaries of each discipline. She has been the recipient of numerous prizes and awards, including the Presidential Design Award, the National Endowment of the Arts Artist Award, the Award in Architecture from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the U.S. State Department's Medal of Arts. And a week or so ago, she was one of the initial recipients of the Portrait of a Nation Award given by the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. She has a site-specific installation currently on view as part of the Wonder Exhibition at the Smithsonian's renovated Renwick Gallery, and now Maya Lin Topologies, a comprehensive monograph devoted to her work spanning over three decades, has been published by Rizzoli. I'm very pleased that it brings Maya Lin back to our show. Hi.
Hi.
Did I leave out any of the awards?
I don't know. I don't think so.
The photographs in this book are quite successful in capturing a sense of the dimension and the expansiveness of much of your work, and they give an idea of how they interact with the environment. Were you involved with taking them?
Oh, not so much taking the actual pictures, but it took about 2 years to sequence the body of work, because it's a little unusual because I sort of split my time between three different disciplines. And so the pacing and how the whole book was structured was probably the hardest thing to do.
Do the different disciplines all interact with each other?
They completely interact between my ears.
But that's it.
That's it. I think formally I chose to make the architecture almost more in a way like a Japanese house works. It frames views and connects you to the land, but tries not to as much mimic the land, whereas the artworks are very much, whether it's the interior, the smaller museum works, which are really almost mappings and cartographies, or they're very gestural responses cut into the earth.
When did you discover their affection for Japanese architecture? After all, Japan and China, and not that, I mean, you were born in Ohio, and you talk about having not much of a sense of ethnicity from much of your youth, but when did Japan come into your aesthetic?
What's very funny, and I think this is one of these things where some things we learn by reading or being taught, other things I think you absorb culturally just with how you were brought up. So my father was a ceramicist who was also, he made a lot of the furniture. The house was, I would call, kind of a 50s Chinese modern. And when we went to China with my mother, my dad didn't travel that time, and visited his childhood home in Fujian, it was Japanese in style because his mother loved Japanese architecture. So it was never said, but in a funny way, the way he had done everything from the bowls we ate from to the furniture we sat on, there was a definite affinity to a more simpler ideal of you could mix in, you know, 50s modernism in America with sort of Japanese traditional design. I don't know, but I think he imbued our house with it, and then I had an affinity to it.
Wasn't one of your relatives the first female architect in China? Also influenced by Japanese ideas?
Yeah, her name was Lin Wei-in, and she was my father's half-sister. And
so you inherited this through the genes?
I don't know if you do. I think it was just in the air. I guess certain things get passed down within families that are maybe just in the way we see the world, and I think both my mother and father had influenced my brother and I quite strongly.
Haven't many architects also done other things, designed furniture, sometimes even the dishes? Frank Lloyd Wright, I think, pretty much wanted to do everything that some Calatrava is also exhibits as a sculptor. And
right.
Do they all, you said it's all in between your ears, in effect, it's in your brain, but there must be some kind of connection. There's a reason why Mies van der Rohe designed chairs.
I think the design and furniture, again, these are functional arts. I think the making of art, which I think Calatrava as well as Gary have done, I think I would say I'm coming out of it probably more from an arts tradition. And I was probably casting bronzes by the time I was in high school. You know, I my dad was dean of fine arts, so I had the entire art school as my playground. I would say though I build buildings, my intuitive processing and creative processing is much more that of an artist. And I think it took going through undergrad and graduate in architecture, where actually the teachers, by the time I finished graduate school, they thought I was a rebel. I wasn't a rebel. I was literally just probably spending more time over in the art department at that point and really finding my voice. And I do think for me, and I think with others it's completely different, I've chosen to really keep formally the art very distinct and different from the architecture. And I would say that the architecture is all about, it's a very functional art.
So you follow Louis Sullivan's dictum, form follows function, there?
Yes and no. I mean, absolutely there's art within architecture. But for me, what I broke from, which was always in my training, I think to be able to break free completely and almost to put everything away and just go into your studio and make whatever you want, that's the voice that I think has come out and really has emerged. And I think Topologies is the first to really share how the evolution of the work has proceeded and kept itself in separate worlds, in the art, in the architecture.
You've said that you do not think that you can find a reason for everything that you make.
Yes.
So just an idea occurs to you, you do it and don't question where it came from.
Well, I think there are times when in architecture you are actually trained always to kind of discuss it, to present it, to explain it. And I think for me, my art does tap into a much more, I don't want to say intuitive, because I think there's as much reasoning going on, but I don't think it's an articulated reasoning.
I'm speaking with Maya Lin, now the subject of a comprehensive monograph from Rizzoli called Maya Lin Topologies. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But think about those pictures that we started this conversation with. Is your work usually about place?
I think my work is definitely grounding you. And I think what I'm always trying to do, and I think it's a curiosity, can I get you to look at literally what you're standing on and maybe rethink your relationship to the land? Or if you're inside, say, in a museum show, I often choose critical bodies of water that are maybe right under your feet, and just trying to get you to be much more aware of your surroundings, or maybe connecting you back to nature.
Well, one of your most famous pieces in this area you kind of feel like you're on water even though you're on land.
Right, Storm King Wayfield, yeah.
What about the piece that you've just done for the Smithsonian? It's described as a celebration of Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah, it's called Folding the Chesapeake. The Renwick has gone through 2 years of a really extensive renovation. It's a very historic building, and the curator, Nicholas Bell, invited 9 artists to open the museum. We each went and chose a room. I kind of was probably one of the last to come, so I said, what rooms are left? And there was one that was beautifully sunlit. And this is a very traditional, historic building. And I just had this inclination. I took a drawing of the Chesapeake I had made, and I started folding up the edges of the paper to form the room. So what if I could make a sculptural rendition of the Chesapeake Bay and let it flow like water wherever it wanted to go? And this is where I had an idea of using a type of very special type of 60s craft marble, slightly flawed. It's not meant for show. It's meant to be melted to make glass. And I just started gluing it, adhering it to the walls, and it looks like water. And it goes from the floor, it takes over most of the floor, except where there's a path to walk through the room, goes up the ceilings, ignores the detailing, the vents, the architecture, just wherever it needed to go, and then goes to the ceiling. So it kind of plays with, I don't know, this solidifying water, and it catches the light because a marble refracts light in a kind of very unpredictable way. So it's definitely almost making water solid for a minute.
Have you become more concerned about environmental issues over the course of your career?
The irony is I went to college to study environmental in field zoology. I think my mother and father were always scratching their head because I was a kid out in the Kroger parking lot boycotting Japan to save the whales. I was boycotting steel traps. I was pretty avid as an environmentalist from the get-go. And I think for me, my work has always, I've always said, and I really do mean this, nothing I can do can be as beautiful as what I'm seeing in the natural world. But what I'm trying to do is respond to that beauty. And I don't know why, but I think I'm extremely aware of, and I think it's because I grew up in the 60s, and for me, with the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Lake Erie catching on fire, it influenced me strongly, and especially now with climate change, I feel we don't have much time, and we need to turn this around.
So Rachel Carson was an influence. But getting back to that point, you don't think that you can find a reason for everything you make. Do you find a reason like a love of the environment after you've made the thing? Say, oh, gee, that's what I was thinking?
I think for me now, especially in my art, I am, and I've always been just keenly in love with looking at the beauty of the world. I do think there is a political bent to my work, probably all of it, and that I'm trying to get you to focus and pay closer attention, sometimes to history, sometimes to cultural events. I think for my art, I have also become a bit of an advocate in my work, though it's always a tricky line because I don't want to say my work is inherently political. I think it's also a drawing that I'm as in love with revealing a water terrain, a topographic terrain, just because it's almost like a childish need. I need to see it. I need to touch it. But at the same time, I'm focusing a lot on disappearing waterways, aquifers. I mean, one of the things I want to hit next is the aquifers that are, you can't see them, but we've really depleted them and all around the world. So that's something that will probably turn into an artwork.
Water a lot. But
water a lot.
It's interesting when you say, we talk about politics, you know, the first work that made you famous, incredible success and attention as a 21-year-old, was the Vietnam Memorial, winning the Vietnam Memorial competition. And the politics there was less from you, but from other people. Were you surprised by the political outcry that resulted?
In a funny way, no. But
I mean, Donald Trump didn't say a word, but you would expect today that he and a number of the other candidates would be screaming about it, although the memorial today is considered an almost sacred place.
I mean, I think they did scream at their time. There just wasn't Instagram, so they couldn't scream as suddenly or as furiously. So it was I probably got off lucky. You know, there were some, it was pretty intense, but it was also very short-lived. The piece was, I designed it and we had it built within a year, and that actually probably helped. If it had delayed longer, I think politics being what they are, meddling usually takes place. So we were actually, I think, very fortunate that it was kind of announced and then built all in a very short time frame.
But then there were people who, there was almost a racist response in some cases.
I think there might have
been.
They
were upset that you were an Asian doing a memorial to people who'd fallen in an Asian war, although it wasn't in China in any way.
I mean,
you were from Ohio.
Yeah. What I think is really interesting is how contemporary art and abstraction actually is. I mean, there's a sort of a pull. It's, you actually get into more trouble doing realism and figurative usually. So there was a lot being read into that piece, its color, my heritage. But I think in the end, you know, it was a very politically controversial war, and I think that also contributed. But for me, it was trial by fire. And I think it's been very interesting because you start with something like that, and I got labeled as an architect in a way because it's, again, a memorial is a little bit of a functional art. And even though I was always making art, and through graduate school I was beginning to really split into these two different voices, and probably definitely I'm much more of an artist, it took maybe a decade before people would say, I really enjoyed the piece I saw at the Wexner Center for the Arts, or I like, you know, the first of the Wayfields was in University of Michigan. But I think we do live in a world of specialization, and if you get labeled as an architect, it might take you a little bit of extra time to actually say, you know, I balance between the two. And I think I deliberately, my first book was Boundaries, and it was deliberately a book I wrote because a lot of times in my thinking, my sketches are words first. And so I felt the first book out would not be the monograph, would deliberately be a written book. So it was deliberately smaller so that it was an in-between state. You couldn't decide if it was to be read or to be looked at. And so I waited until there was enough art, enough architecture. And to be honest, there will be five memorials, and those are far enough along to kind of complete topologies.
But there's also just that whole issue of what a memorial should be like and what it should celebrate. Many of the memorials in this country are celebrations of victories. I have a really ugly statue in a park across the street from me that is a memorial to the soldiers, the brave soldiers of World War I. But in this case, it was a war that was a very painful part of American history.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that, you know, from that point, I've selected certain other what I would call memory works, civil rights, the women's table at Yale, a project throughout the Pacific Northwest Confluence, which intertwines, you know, the history of Lewis and Clark with the Native American tribes, with ecological issues, and now finally what is missing. These to me are learning from history. And I think I have a firm belief that if I can kind of produce the facts of a moment in time and ask you, the viewer, to come away with your own conclusions, which to be honest is probably much more an Eastern way of thinking, not that I was ever aware of that. It's what can we learn from our past in order to maybe guide us into a different future.
Did the time you spent in Denmark influence your ideas about memorials?
They did. But it was not the way you were thinking of. I was given a part of Denmark that had the largest cemetery in Denmark. And in Europe, because space is at a premium, cemeteries are not something that are put away. People live, they're parks. And so I probably was thinking, well, America's a very young country, and we're very youth-oriented. We're in a little bit of a denial. And so when I got back to Yale, when I focused on the design of the memorial, I wanted to make a piece that would be very honest and really focused in on the individuals.
I'm speaking with Maya Lin. A new monograph has been published by Rizzoli called Maya Lin Topologies, a huge book. I don't know how many pounds this weighs, Maya, but it is heavy and gorgeous at the same time. Incredible photographs. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Maya Lin, and we're talking about her work, her distinguished career over how many years now?
Around 35.
So that's when the Vietnam Memorial went up,
81.
35 years? And there's a new book that covers much of her career called Topologies. It's from Rizzoli. A caller who works in film, a friend of our show, in fact, Dennis Doris, told my producer that your father is a wonderful man and a huge influence on his life. In fact, the reason he's in film.
Really? I didn't know that.
What was your father's connection with film?
He was dean of fine arts, so he was a potter. He was a ceramicist who had done academic administration in China immigrated to the U.S. as the communists were coming in, didn't think he'd get a comparable academic position, did something his parents never wanted him to go into, which is the arts, studied ceramics as a second career, became fairly accomplished, and then little by little got back into academic administration, frankly, to make more money at OU so he could put his kids through college.
Because your family had lost everything.
Family met in the States. My mother came out to go to Smith College. She had $20 sewn into the collar of her coat, and my dad had to have three or four jobs at a time to put himself through grad school.
And yet you've talked about how ethnicity wasn't something that you thought much about until people started attacking you for being
Asian. I know.
Or did they understand that Chinese, Vietnamese, Japanese, Indian, they're all Asian, but they're different?
No, I don't think
Cambodian.
They
did. I mean, we could go on.
And I was extremely naive, because I think when you grow up in an academic environment, it's not really the color of your skin and or your gender. It's what you know. And it didn't even occur to me that my race would become an issue.
You mentioned your first book, Boundaries. And in that, you suggested that you were interested in limits. But hasn't your art and your architecture been about kind of transcending limits?
Oh, I've always thought of Boundaries was actually the space between things. In fact, there's one picture of the edge of the ocean meeting the land. I was interested in the in-between place of things rather than the container of things. So it's kind of a funny thing. I think it's always been about the tension between opposites, or as I said, like the place where opposites meet. And I don't know, it's like a different dimension for me.
What do you look for in an architectural project? For example, you designed the Museum of Chinese in America down here in New York's Chinatown.
I'm very guarded what I take on, partly because I really can only take on one architectural project at a time, given that I'm busy with, you know, what is missing, as well as with many different art installs and exhibits. So I have helped, I think, whether it's the Sculpture Center, Museum of Chinese in America, early Museum of African Art, there have been small not-for-profits. I have a firm belief that design shouldn't just be relegated for those, you know, who have a lot more means. So I've always liked to help out. Secondly, I've done a couple, you know, private things, but a lot has been in the public realm. I'm finishing right now one of my first, I would say, commercial venture, institutional commercial, is for Novartis, and I'm building out their campus extension in Cambridge. But again, the project has to be something where I love urban infill, and this was like the last area on Mass Ave that was almost a black hole. It was an abandoned parking lot. So this now completes the link between Kendall and Central Square. All of the ground floor footage is being given back to retail, so it will really enliven the street. And then I was extremely careful with the scale. So along the street side, the building is low. It's four stories to match the surrounding Mass Ave views. And then the taller eight-story building is set back. So again, pretty humanist when I want to accept a commission. And again, I'm very committed to environmentally sustainable materials, energy efficiency, and also, again, getting back to that Japanese influence, can the architecture help frame and give you a different connection back to the land? So with the Novartis project, this whole master plan, which I had done, has a 1.5-acre public park in the center of it.
As somebody who also makes art, are you sensitive to the debate over what a good exhibition space should look like? Because we go from the white cube approach to the Guggenheim,
right,
which most artists absolutely hate, but it's still a great building.
I think certain buildings have become works of art, and I would say the Guggenheim is one of my favorite. I also love the Whitney. Some buildings, from an artist's point of view, are in a way easier to install in, but at the same time, and again, I can be very site-specific with some of my installs, so to be able to have a dialogue with the building, like at the Renwick, is also just part of working within your white box. And if the white box isn't necessarily a white box, it can be just as intriguing to me. Though it can be also difficult. Sometimes standing back and looking at a painting exhibit in the Guggenheim, when I always feel like I'm in a slight slant.
It's you
sort
are.
Of discontent. I'm in a slight slant. But I also think I respect architecture.
I always felt
that
you should
also,
see the art on roller skates.
Yeah, a little too quick, I think. You'd end up at the bottom way too quick. But no, I think it's a variety. I don't think there's one prescription. I do think for my architecture, I like the frame to be a lot quieter so that the light comes in and filters in, and I prefer to install in kind of a calmer, quieter space.
And are you thinking about the art that's going to go into the space? Because different art looks different in different spaces.
I think for my artworks, a lot of times when I'm working within, well, it really depends. Some of my artworks, and I kind of broke the art chapters into three. There's these very large outdoor earthworks, whether it's the Storm King Wayfield or some earth drawings that I've made, or there's this there are artworks that have been made for commissions where I'm definitely having to respond to the architecture. And the challenge there, like the first one of these was 43 tons of glass poured into these outdoor, almost moat-like areas of Eisenman's building at the Wexner Center. How do you take over with an artwork, respond to the architecture, but not be influenced so that your work becomes architectonic? It's a challenge, and I love that because for me, I ended up creating what would be almost liquid poured broken glass. So it looks like water. It's a little bit linking because it's in Columbus, Ohio, an Asian kind of moat, sort of the rake sand gardens, with the fact that I was very strongly influenced by the Indian mounds of southeastern Ohio.
You mentioned earlier that you also have a love for words and like to use words. And there are a number of pieces, Reading a Garden and then The Meeting Room, that use words. There's always been a debate within the art world about artists using words and where do you, if you could write it, why even bother making an art piece? But where does literariness end and visual begin?
Well, I think it doesn't. It's not like a cut and dried place. I actually felt, and this was what took the longest for me, the gardens. I've always done them, but in a funny way, I see the gardens so different.
Landscape, you're a landscape gardener
design.
On the side?
Yeah, that was a horror. It's like add one more profession to the mix. No, the same way in my art, I have an interior and an exterior, inside-outside component. In architecture and design, I have both an outside and the buildings as the interior. And it was the gardens which were the hardest for me. And I'd never really talked about them as a group because I was very acutely aware that try not to add one more discipline to the mix. And yet my response is I am problem solving. I've taken on these inner city areas that were actually quite degraded, quite bombed out at times, and I had to fix them. It was almost like I wanted to help. So they're urban infill, and they tap into that functional art, which for me is almost antithetical or 180 degrees different from, say, what I would do at Storm King Wayfield.
You also did a piece with your brother
yeah.
at the University of Ohio.
Two pieces in Ohio.
Is that collaboration easier because he's your brother?
I think my brother taught me to look at poetry. And I would say I'm always trying to get back to almost that. And he's a language poet, so it's using poetry in a very abstract way. It's been easy. It's been actually a really fluid working with him. And we're, you know, the site of an artist is an outdoor site. The site for a poet is a book. We've done two input in
Athens,
Ohio.
You have a third one
Ohio.
Coming up in Oberlin.
Yep, and the second one was at the Cleveland Public Library Reading and Garden. And I've been waiting for the third site because for a book, we want to do like an elegy series. We want to do an homage to our home state.
You've said that what is missing will be your last memorial. What's it a memorial to?
It's a memorial that focuses on the environment. So all the other four, civil rights, women's rights, Native American, and Vietnam, all I was commissioned, basically, or I entered a competition. For me, I've been wanting for almost 20 years that I knew that I would create the last of the memorials. So I set up a foundation. It's called What is Missing, and it talks about what we're losing in terms of the environment, species and habitat, but very much is focused on, and I think all the memorials have been focused on, how can we learn from our past, how can we wake people up to what's going on, and then what is missing is extremely proactive. There's got a part of it that will tell you what you can do in your everyday choices to what we're working on and have been working on for almost a year called Greenprint, which will, what can those artists do to get you to realize possible, almost macro view solutions?
You may be one of the few architects, well, there are a number now that have progressive ideas, but there was a time when many architects were conservatives, flirted with fascism, and now with people like you and Gary, we're moving in another direction. The book Myelin Topologies is published by Rizzoli. It's a huge and gorgeous book. And Maya, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.